For as long as I've known the NBA, it's been a stars league. But even among the stars, there's an exclusive club. Russell and Dr. J. Bird and Magic. Jordan. Kobe. They're all part of a select group that paved the way for the NBA superstar of today. And some even shared secrets with each other along the way. Join me as I trace the evolution of the NBA icon from the early days.
And he said, "Tell me, Pat, who is Julius Erving?" I said, "Well, Vince, he's the Babe Ruth of basketball."
Through the years of icons.
We noticed that everything he did looked like Michael. To the moves, to the walk, to the talk. Like, it was like a ongoing joke.
All the way to today. From Spotify and the Ringer Podcast Network, I'm Jackie McMullen. And this is the Icons Club. The series premieres on March 18th on the Book of Basketball 2.0 feed.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
Welcome to the Ringer F1 Show. I'm Kevin Clark, joined by two guests today. The first one I've potted about Formula One with for a long time. It's Ryan Russillo. He makes his Ringer F1 Show debut. We go through the last two episodes of Drive to Survive Season 4 on Netflix, and we use that as jumping off point for the Max versus Lewis rivalry, Red Bull versus Mercedes, things we're excited about in 2022, an amazing electric segment. It ends with a James Bond rant about dating apps that you're really going to want to hear. And then Matthew Summerfield joins me. He's the assistant technical editor at Motorsport. He explains technical innovation really simply and really well. We go through the best cars with him. Amazing show. Buckle up. All right. It's time for the big one. Ryan Russillo. We've gone abroad from going abroad. Incredible winter. A lot of Ferrari buzz. Our friends at Haas having some amazing times. McLaren in the mud a little bit. Ryan Russillo, welcome to the Ringer F1 pod, buddy.
I didn't think this was going to be a political pod. Can we say our friends at Haas?
I don't have any friends at Haas.
Right. I'm just saying, like, I sent out a Haas tweet because I didn't understand their funding. And then I sent out the tweet before I saw season 4. And I was like, I don't know. Like, how do I handle Haas? Like, it feels like if the Miracle on Ice was made up of, you know, Murph and O'Donnell and O'Doul. And then also there's a Pavel and a Fedorov in there as well, a Bure. So I don't know what to do with Haas now.
Well, it sounds like they're going to be okay. Mick Schumacher and Magnussen are way more likable than Mazepin. There are no Mazepins. There's no one from the Mazepin family still associated with Haas.
Oh, okay. So
I'm
we're
feeling good.
Good
about it.
We're good. Great. Yeah. Mazepin, you could tell the way that season 4 was edited, the people wanted you to know, this guy fucking sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mazepin was cut from the team in a press release. Gunther didn't even call him.
Yeah, because the father was going to... There's some serious nepotism in F1, which again is my first year really learning about it. I mean, this is like, I'm not going to say the joke, but let's just say there were certain decisions made at a time where you were like, why? Like, that guy doesn't even work here, and we're hiring his kid. And so you'd be like, what fuck? And so then you're like, wait, guys are like, I'm going to pull my funding for your chassis and gearboxes if my kid. And so Mazepin, we shouldn't lead with this, but let's just make sure that people understand this is not going to be a political podcast. So that's good. It's good to know.
All right. So we're here to do a couple things. The biggest task at hand is recapping episodes 9 and 10 of Drive to Survive. It's been a year since you got into this thing. Episodes 9 and 10 are some of the biggest drama in modern F1 history. It basically recaps the last two races of the season. It recaps the end of the most thrilling title race, certainly since I've been watching the sport, which is, what, 4 or 5 years? And for a lot of people, you'd have to go back decades to find anything like this, at least a decade. This was amazing stuff. Your first takeaway from, and let's start with episode 9. Let's not get to the last lap and the controversy and all that stuff. It sets the stage where Lewis Hamilton comes out and says, I have a track record of not crashing with people. Max pushes the envelope. It feels like everybody was playing their character in these last two episodes, Ryan.
All right, this season was incredible. I don't know if the budget was increased too. The shots alone should win awards. And then I didn't quite realize that in my first full end-to-end season of F1, it'd be like somebody going to Kirk Gibson's home run in 88 off of Eckersley, and that's their first live sporting experience, right? And then they sit there for nine, you know, whatever, however many innings, and then be like, is it like this all the time? It'd be like going to Texas at Texas Tech when Graham Harrell and Crabtree connect to beat Texas and Lubbock. And then you're like, is this what every college football game is like? I could go on and on, but I don't know that any of them do a service to what this season was. So then on top of it, to have the bird magic of F1 and Verstappen and Hamilton, which is a little different because it's different generations and Hamilton's run through all this. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, like, who am I actually rooting for? Because at first I'm like, well, I don't want to just root for Mercedes. That seems lame. And then I think the other thing that I think makes it feel like any other American sport, Kevin, is that, you know, I haven't known what a catch is for years. We add in more replay and all it does is make the game boring and fuck up everything. It doesn't solve any deals. And as I'm watching all of these crashes all season long, whether it's Raikkonen on the call or somebody else, none of them agree. So I never know who's at fault. I never know what to make of it. So in the penultimate Grand Prix, we've got the brake test controversy where I was stuck in a YouTube wormhole, Kev, trying to figure out, like, did Verstappen brake test? Because part of me is like, just like in Dominican Sue, when he used to kick everybody in the dick, I'm like, you know what? He's one of the best athletes I've ever seen play college football. I think he knows when he's kicking somebody. I actually do. And so these other people be on Twitter being like, no, his body's just huge. He's flailing. He can't control it. So when people say that Verstappen didn't brake test Lewis Hamilton and have him rear-end him, it's like, yeah, but I mean, this is one of the greatest human beings behind the wheel of a car at a 7+ billion of us.
It defies logic that he wouldn't have known what he was doing. I've gotten in a wormhole of Nico Rosberg, who's got a great YouTube page. He just gets in the sim and just goes through different tracks and is like, here's how you do this, here's how you do that. And he's just kind of messing around on one of the laps. And the control he has over the car when he's just kind of playing around, like, he can't actually screw up. Like, he's just going through a slow lap and he's like, let me stop right here, show you what to do. And then he's like perfect on the curb, all of this stuff. Even in the sim, even a guy who's been retired for 5 years, these guys know exactly where to put their car. And you see that even when, like, Esteban Ocon is leading a race. You see they never go wide. They just know these are the 20, in most cases, they're 20 of at least the 50 best drivers in the world. Obviously, when there's a pay driver, that's a different conversation. If they're a super pay driver like Mazepin, then it's an extremely different conversation. But these are unbelievable drivers. And so I don't believe in coincidences and those sort of things when it comes to Verstappen versus Hamilton.
So, you know, the other part of this, and well said, is that, you know, you're sitting there and you're going, all right, well, who do I like better? You know, and then I feel like if I'm rooting for Lewis Hamilton, it's like getting into baseball in the late 90s going, I like the Yankee logo, I'll root for them. You know, it's like it's like being from South Florida and rooting for the fucking Cowboys, you know, and then being like, oh,
there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that going around.
Or like, hey, who are your favorite teams? I like Duke. I like the Bulls. I like the Yankees and Cowboys, but the Lakers, I kind of like the Lakers if the Bulls aren't good. And you're like, all right, awesome, awesome. I know everything I need to know about you. So I felt like I was leaning Red Bull. And the way it always would turn out is like Max, you know, he's got three did not finishes over the course of 21. Mm-hmm. And he's got the crash at Azerbaijan, not going to work here anymore.
All good.
Yeah, not going to work here anymore. He's got the crash at Silverstone where Lewis just clips him, but then Lewis is the first to say he didn't give me any space. And then Red Bull's like, you try to kill our fucking driver. I don't know who to believe. And then Mons is the really bad one where on the call they're saying that Max didn't do anything wrong, but it looked pretty clear that once Hamilton was clear of the pit line, he was more than within his rights to make it difficult for Max. And I think, again, as I kind of go through all this stuff and I've thought about it, because I watched all these crashes again last night prepping for this after watching the season, is I think the best thing for Max is that everybody's scared to death of what he's capable of.
Yes, yes.
And that's the value in the way he drives. So you can hate him, you can think he's dangerous, and Mercedes and Lewis and Toto sell that all fucking season that he's this maniac. But there's something that I think is very important. I'm going to finish here. As I remember earlier in an F1 season where Vettel, when he's still driving for Ferrari, okay, because he was Alpha now, he's with Ferrari, or he's Aston Martin, excuse me, right? And and Vettel, who's won world championships before, he doesn't let his own teammate pass. And everybody that talks about Vettel doing that in this moment, as I'm first learning about the sport, they're going, there's something about you where you have to be an absolute bastard to be a world champion. And because Vettel's old and he's got a couple of pelts already, it was okay when Vettel does this shit. But here's Max as a new brash guy and challenging the Silver Arrows where everything he's doing is dangerous. Wow. And I'm going to just hand it off to you because it dawned on me after watching the entire season again, I'm like, I don't want to hear about Max anymore because this all plays into his favor and will be a big part of his success in his career.
It was amazing after the first crash, the Mercedes crew was Toto and his guys were standing around a corner in a circle. And one of his guys who wasn't Toto was like, this was exactly the right lesson for Max to learn because everyone backs off for Max, right? And so maybe it's like almost like a purpose pitch where Max is going to learn not to push it. Max learned zero lessons. He learned zero lessons. He will not be backing out for anybody. He'd rather crash than let anybody have an inch on him. It's amazing. You sort of see that. We talked about this last year when I had my mind changed a little bit when I saw the Schumacher documentary and a guy got in an accident with Schumi and Schumi was like, I was in the right. And he did. The other driver was like, has ever dawned on you could be wrong in one of these situations? And Schumi was like, no, it hasn't. And like that to me is how you have to be wired in this sport.
By the way, that reminds me of this amazing line I just read the other day where it was like, your knowledge is no match for my ignorance. Go ahead.
So Toto and Horner, I feel like these two episodes, and Horner's given some amazing moments to us. Toto Wolff, the Mercedes team principal, Christian Horner, the Red Bull team principal, they've been going at it for years. It all climaxes in these two episodes. Susie Wolff, Toto's wife, an accomplished driver in her own right, a great motorsports mind, comes in and is just like, oh, it must be so tough for Christian to see Toto having won so many years. Like everybody was doing such a great job. Toto compared Christian Horner to a Jack Russell Terrier who will bite at your heels. They had the press conference where Horner essentially said, we don't have a relationship.
Which Horner, by the way, admits in one of the side parts of like, yeah, I antagonized the shit out of those guys, but go ahead.
Yes. And he says that's part of the sport. And it's part of and you see the working of the refs. Mercedes had their car inspected by Red Bull. Lewis couldn't believe it. He's going around the paddock saying, can they do this? Yes, they can. The working of the refs was happening all year long. You saw there was almost foreshadowing all season long. Whether that was, there was a conversation with Michael Massey at one point in episode 9 where Christian's working Michael Massey. Massey's not even in the meeting where the Max penalty is being determined. But there's just everybody's working along the edges the whole time. And you can see how everything led up to a complete clusterfuck in the last race of the season in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, like Toto, it's funny. You really start like I feel like my level of knowledge is so different because I actually now watched a full season and cared about it in the week. Like I start reading stuff about it where I watched the first three seasons of the F1 show and I didn't really know what the hell was going on. I also think it is a side, Netflix, F1, they should get together and they should have some sort of tutorial thing. There should be a standalone episode that's not even part of any season where there's a tutorial because I didn't understand any of it until I actually started watching the races, and I think it'd be valuable. I also thought they were a little skimpish on replaying a lot of the crashes, and specifically the Monza crash where Max is on top of Lewis, which you pointed out immediately, like Max revving the fucking tires while he has no idea if he's on Lewis's head. Every time that was cut, every time that was shown, which was very rare, they didn't like to show a lot of crashes over and over again in the F1 series. They never left us with the one where he drives over the halo as Max is trying to get off the car to see if, like, hey, can I actually get back in this race? Because he doesn't, I mean, he's there to race. But Toto, like, I don't dislike Horner and Toto, but it reminds me of the void that we have so much in American sports where, like, seeing Durant and Embiid get into it last week, I was thrilled to see it because you know why? We don't get to see it that much. And here we are every week and the new season starting where it's Lewis and Max, Red Bull, Mercedes, that we like, it's a different sport. It's a hard thing for maybe people to grasp. It's intimidating at first. It was for me, certainly. But there's a drama element that goes on with this sport that is, that is not only shared, but seems to be at another level than we've had the last few years in team sports here in the States.
But part of that is there's a insecurity that is bred by the team element of it. And what I mean by that is you saw Mazepin v. Mick Schumacher, and Schumacher has the same car as Mazepin. Schumacher's beating the brakes off of him, and Mazepin's only excuse is, it's not the same car. You guys are screwing me. Right.
Yeah, right. You're doing it to me on purpose.
Right. You're doing it to me on purpose. I'm going to pull the funding. My dad is going to shut down the team, all that stuff. Because you have the same car, and I've made this analogy before, it's the equivalent of if last year Jimmy Garoppolo got to run an entire season with the Niners offense, and so did Trey Lance. And what happens when Trey Lance on Sunday does better than Jimmy Garoppolo with all the same variables, all the same play calls, all the same resources? Then Jimmy Garoppolo starts making excuses. And that's why this sport is so tilted towards drama, because there's 20 seats. You can lose them easily. In Max's case, there's $50 million a year on the line. In team principals' cases, it's tens of millions of dollars. They light their homes in Oxfordshire. Like, there is so much on the line, and there's no hiding. There's no hiding in Formula One, and that's what I think is amazing.
And that's where I think that we're drawn to it, that it's the same element of the drama. Like, baseball doesn't have drama that we care about nationally anymore. We do locally, we just don't nationally. The NBA has a lot of national drama that people care about constantly. And here's a sport where the concept is pretty simple. Like, who's got the fastest car? And it evolves in this class, and they're smart to remind us. Like, this is it. Not that they're the 20 best drivers, because you start to learn more about the sport and all the bullshit that goes through it. Like, I'm telling you right now, George Russell, if he looks like Valtteri, he's not in the Mercedes-Benz seat. He's not. Right. Like, if it was reversed where Valtteri looks like George Russell, Valtteri keeps his seat as the second driver for Mercedes. So I just love, too, that, like, this is the other part of it, too. And this isn't even an American. It's I've done rants on this before, is that we do navigate through life just kind of hoping to avoid being fucked over. And the times we do get fucked over, we're sort of pre-expecting it. It's why I think college football fans are like anxiety-riddled freaks for about 4 months, because they're like, look, my team's really good, but I know the committee's going to fuck me. And you're just expecting it because all these different things that happen to you. You have Lewis Hamilton, who's won 7 world championships, acting like he's getting fucked at every turn. And then yet it felt like every decision went against Max and Red Bull early on, whether Lewis clips him and it's a 10-second penalty. Max has another time where it's during the double yellow flag during qualifying. FWO. Yeah, which, you know, look, if you know Max at this point, he doesn't give a shit. He sees the double yellow and he's like, I have a chance for pole, so I'm not stopping.
What was funny about this season is Big Cat had one of the funniest lines when we did this segment with him last year, when he said, he asked me if Christian Horner was a Karen. And, you know, it's always, is that legal? I don't know. Is that legal? And he's, you know, kind of alerting things. And you got to see everybody turn into a Karen because the drama got so heightened. So it's Lewis. You mentioned the double yellow. Lewis going around in the paddock and saying, like, what is going on with this double yellow? Look at these times. They're like, Toto, come look at this. James, come look at this. Ron, come look at this. And I think that you got to see everybody in the political element of the sport, I think, right? And that's and that I think is important to note is how political the sport can be. And that's why we had the situation in the last race is that it's all politics. It is all politics. By the way, you mentioned the halo thing. The damage that Lewis's car took on and his helmet and the tire marks on his helmet, I obviously understood the gravity of that situation, but seeing the damage that Lewis took on from Verstappen, that was unbelievable. If that had happened five years before and there's no halo, we're talking about severe, severe stuff, man.
No, I mean, really, maybe even death. And Toto admits, yes. Like, the funny thing is, if you're listening to us to this point, you know, 15 minutes into the podcast, you're like, oh, are these guys like anti-Toto? And I don't think I am. I think we all need Toto Wolff. Like, we need these guys. And that's what I think is perfect about the way if you were casting a show, it's cast perfectly. And Toto admits, like, 4 years ago, I was anti-Halo. And I was like, you know, this is pre-me. You know, I'm thinking like, oh, what was the argument against? Was the argument against the Halo, the divider support right down the middle, that it's okay. Somehow like, why would you put this right in the middle of the field of vision for a driver?
A, that was one. Number two, it honestly just doesn't look very cool. And number three, and you get this with NASCAR sometimes, there's a segment that doesn't like pure safety. They like the danger element of it. Like, the movie Rush starts out with Niki Lauda, played by Daniel Brühl, saying, you know, with 20 drivers, we have 20 races a year. I'm paraphrasing here. And every year, one of us dies, right? So for like 50 years, there was a part where it was like, all right, well, there's this danger element. And you had this in other car racing circuits as well. Thankfully, thank God, that is not the case anymore. And every, even this in Formula One, unfortunately it is in other series, but I think that there are still some of the, I listened to a very famous pundit a couple of months ago for an interview in 2018 who was against the Halo. And he was saying that I don't think the safest people on the grid at a Formula One race should be the drivers. That is an actual argument that I've heard. It's very strange, but thank God the Halo is here. And I think that accident put any of that beyond doubt. And we've had accidents in the past that have proven the Halo's worth as well.
I think it looks cool, but again, I'm new to this. So I think when they did those slow motion, like high res shots where it looks almost like a cartoon and everything's shaking, the shots alone, it feels like the budget was cranked up quite a bit because of the success of this whole thing. But you're driving this, so keep going in whatever direction, because we kind of like, I just feel like we haven't gotten to the race yet and I don't know where you want to go. So I don't want to mess anything up. You're driving.
All right. So I want to get to one more thing before we get to the actual race. Number one, Lewis Hamilton freaking out about the cameras, I thought was a really interesting moment. So if anybody hasn't seen it yet or missed it, there's a scene where Lewis Hamilton's giving an interview and he's talking to somebody and there's just the clicking of cameras over and over and over again. And he's freaking out. And eventually he just gets up and leaves and says, there's a time and place for cameras. I don't want it to be now. I don't think that was the pressure getting to Lewis Hamilton. I just think that I think at some point someone gets to be too famous and he's crossed that. I mean, LeBron has crossed that. Serena Williams, Messi, Ronaldo. I mean, there's a video of Ronaldo a couple of years ago where he just put a GoPro on to go buy tea in like a Madrid mall. And it's the most amazing video I've ever seen. He can't take a sip without someone trying to take a selfie. And so you got to see a little bit of the human element with Lewis because he's always so cool, calm, and collected. It was interesting. I actually enjoyed seeing that human element where he was just like, I can't do cameras right now, guys.
Yeah. I mean, and the word is, right, Max isn't doing it next season.
Yeah, he's done. Well, he didn't really participate this year. He didn't have any on-camera interviews. It was all kind of secondhand stuff with Horner.
But I thought he was shutting down even more of that, which is a joke. That's bad. That's a bad look for Max.
I agree. And Lewis has an Apple deal now, which hopefully doesn't interfere with this. Hopefully he understands that this is the show that is the entree point for a lot of fans internationally, not just American fans, but just a lot of people who are new to the sport. All right, let's get to the last race. Your first takeaway from the new angle of that race. I was intrigued to see every angle of the Latifi accident, which I hadn't really seen. The Latifi accident, which kicked off everything. I'd seen a lot of this stuff, the radio stuff, the stuff inside the paddock with Mercedes and Red Bull going back and forth on the last lap. Was there anything that stood out to you, surprised you when we're actually talking about the last episode and the last lap?
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton.
Let's do it.
I think the best thing to do is to kind of run through it.
Yep.
So Latifi, we're looking at Hamilton leading the race. He's going to win. There's five laps to go. Again, Abu Dhabi here. And Latifi on the radio that we now have access to, because I don't think we would have heard a ton of this during the actual broadcast because we just wouldn't have cared about Latifi's position.
Right.
You know, they're racing at the back end of this. And the paddock's like, hey, you need to push a little. You need Let's to push. Go. I mean, just late. Look, last race, last couple laps.
Yep.
You've got this a little bit
last,
more.
Last chance for you to pass Schumacher.
Yeah. So that's what all they said. Of this, right. Yeah. All of this is happening. And it, you know, look, I'm not telling them and their team that it doesn't mean anything, but it didn't mean anything.
It's like politics. All Formula One is local, right?
Right.
Like all that Latifi's race engineer cares about is, I don't care what's going on at the front of the grid. I care about Latifi maxing out today.
Right. And a Williams of all the cars too, where you're just like, you know, the Williams story has not been a great one the last couple of years. So Latifi slams, just he's not even caught up with anybody else, slams to somebody else. And now it's like, okay, now it's on. And, you know, we're down to this absolute tiebreaker of a race, essentially for the world championship for Max and Lewis. And so then this leads to pit strategy because Lewis couldn't give away his position. So he actually was fucked by being in first. And then again, correct anything. I just think it's cool for people to understand the timeline of events here. Maybe aren't even watching and just listen to us. So now you're like, all right, Max has got fresh tires. Lewis couldn't pit. And then Max is ahead enough to be able to make it work. But now he's got Checo in front, or is that earlier? Yeah. That was earlier.
That was earlier. Checo holding Hamilton up was a huge inflection point of the race, but that was earlier than this.
Right. Checo was setting screens, rebounding, diving on the ground for balls. And Checo, you're right. So that was all earlier.
He was softening him up, quite frankly. It was body blows.
Exactly. So Checo had held up Lewis earlier to even allow Max to still be in the striking distance, but still behind the pit strategy, fresher tires, ready to go. But now we're like, okay, so take it from here. Just take it from here.
So it's Latifi gets in the accident.
Yep.
And there is a rule, and I'll explain this as maybe as broadly as possible, just in case, again, you're not a Formula One expert and you've been brought into it. Essentially, two things could have happened there. Either the race would have ended under caution if all the cars were allowed to lap themselves, or it would have restarted and there would have been five cars between Lewis and Max who had been lapped, okay? So those are the two options that should have happened by the rules. Instead, Michael Massey decided to make up a rule and essentially let the five cars in between unlap themselves, but nobody else was allowed to unlap themselves. So that led to one kind of, Lewis Hamilton used the word manipulated, I'll use it too. That led to one manipulated lap to determine the world championship. I was explaining this. I actually saw at Sloan a couple weeks ago, I saw Haberstroh and those guys because he's into the rule stuff. And I was explaining this and he was like, we came to the conclusion. It'd be like if the Bucks went up 3-0 on the Lakers and then Adam Silver was like, actually next game wins. And they waited for Giannis to have like a knee problem.
I think that's aggressive.
Okay.
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration to be like, it is a bit of an exaggeration.
Maybe 2-0.
Did Haberstroh suggest that guys miss every other race just to stay fresher? I like Tom.
We didn't get into the load management. That's aggressive. I'll back off on that a little bit. It is kind of tongue in cheek. What is it more?
I know.
What is it more like?
I don't know. It's like when
everybody in the building
knows that it was a fumble and it wasn't, or something like that.
Yeah. If you run that scenario 1,000 times, there's not a whole lot where Verstappen comes out on top.
Okay, all right. Like so that. just so you explain, because I'll admit when I watched it live and then the controversy after and then Massey telling off Toto, essentially, because Toto's losing his mind. Toto is like a villain at the end of some movie where you're just like,
everything's falling. He was getting stolen from him. He was getting the championship stolen from him.
And he's screaming and yelling. But can you point out again, because I don't think everybody caught this, the lapping, the unlapping, basically what they were saying is, no, you go ahead of the pace car, the safety car in this case.
Safety car.
And normal protocol would have been you unlap yourself, but still with only a lap to go and Verstappen allowed to pass all these cars. That's just a lot of work to do. He doesn't have to overtake them, but they have to get out of his way. And that's just like a thing that's going to take a couple turns to happen, even if he's allowed to do it. So basically they were told to get ahead and get out of the way. And get now it's 1-2.
So it could be straight racing. As Michael Massey, who made the decision, said, we're going car racing. It's called we're car going, racing. We're going car racing.
It's a motor race.
Yeah, it's a motor race. We're going car racing. Lance Stroll was actually a great narrator in this because he was like, wait, they're unlapping the safety car. And then they're like, no, Lance, that's just those five cars. And he was like, all right, brother, like whatever. And you saw like George Russell sent the tweet immediately. Like the drivers in the back were just like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, that's, I'll tell you, once I saw that, it's the best point that you've made and you've made many. But once you have people like, I defer to the people that do it for a living.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't mean they're right all the time. And we just pointed out, we've seen an entire season of all the parties telling everyone else they're getting fucked over and that everybody else is wrong and they're right. But when the guys that really had nothing to gain or lose out of it, although I thought originally when Russell tweeted in favor of Hamilton, you're like, well, no shit, well, he's teammate. Yeah. But when Stroll, who was not a major player in season four, we'd admit, the Stroll family.
No surfing. We didn't see any surfing.
No, not well represented in season four. When his radio was like, what are they doing? So it's not that you're just getting out of the way. It's like, no, get out of the way now. And we've got a lap to go. And that's the part where I don't care if you're a Max fan or a Red Bull fan. You have to know deep down that if you're breaking protocol and the guys that do it for a living are like, what the fuck are they doing? Then what's the argument anymore? So yeah,
so
Mercedes got fucked.
The other day they closed the loophole that this will basically never happen again.
That's
they
another reason why it's
they,
a pro
they also
Mercedes
removed,
argument.
They removed Michael Massey from his post. The FIA removed Michael Massey from his post. I mean, it's like, it's like when Joey Crawford got suspended, you know, like they were just like, all right, buddy, this is a little too much for you.
It was like a Mike Carey moment. We're like, I have that as a catch. Like, let's go down to the field. Like, incomplete, third down.
Michael Massey should be a rules official for Sky going forward.
Carey went like 0-for-30. Like he had just an absolute DiMaggio streak at one point. You're like this. You just feel bad for him. Like, oh, I hope they can at least. I hope he's got this one right.
Okay, so Max wins the title. Most people knew that by now. There's the full celebration. Mercedes Lewis at the time said this has been manipulated. I agree with him, as I said earlier. They do the whole celebration, and then they get to what I think is the best scene in the history of the show. Which is out of nowhere.
Toto dressed as
out of nowhere, wearing different clothing that he'd ever worn. He must have shown up to the studio in like January, months after anything had happened, with a roll neck sweater, turtleneck, whatever you want to call it, whatever they got going on in Germany, and just said, they said, does Red Bull have a target on their backs next year? And he said, everyone has a target on their backs next year. Toto, who has had some, as I said, he said the diplomacy was over, I think after Mexico. But I didn't know he was gonna have an extra scene in Drive to Survive where he shows up months afterwards just to talk shit. That was awesome.
I couldn't believe it because his face was different.
He's a different person.
He just looked different. It's like a guy that you thought was dead and then he shows up in the sequel. And you go, what's going on here?
Like
and then again,
like
Sprockets.
Peaky Blinders. Do you watch Peaky Blinders?
Yeah.
Tom Hardy's character has died like three times and then just shows up.
That's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're sitting there and I was like, okay, this is great. And I knew immediately you were just screen grabbing stuff left and right. and you've already shared some of that content with us. But to me, the success of this entire brand of something that's brand new to me, you know, like I love it because I don't really have to know what the fuck I'm talking about that much.
That's right.
You know, I'm not trying to get everything right. I just want to enjoy it. And it's weird as I get older, I start to enjoy stuff that I don't have anything to do with, more so than when it's like, hey, these are all the things that I have to do and I have to be on top of
it. I agree with that.
Right. You know, it's why I like MMA a lot, because I'm just like, you know, hey, I like that guy better than that guy. And I don't want to hear about the fucking VORP.
I went to the ACC tournament last week in Brooklyn, and Miami was playing. And I don't know a damn thing about college hoops, and I could not have enjoyed it more. I was just like, I don't know who these guys are. I know their names. I know Coach Larrañaga's coaching them up. And I got an IPA, and I was just a huge dumbass for 2 hours, and it felt amazing.
Yeah, good for you, man. Good, just living, out there living. But I feel right. like I feel like I like Horner more than I did.
Oh, okay.
I think I like
Max. Yeah, that was my next question. Did you change your mind on anybody this season? Max and Horner.
I kind of like that Max is a psychopath.
Yeah. All right. So let's spin it forward here for our last few minutes. I'm still Team Lewis in that particular rivalry.
Yeah.
Let's spin it forward here for the last thing we're gonna do. Couple things you're looking forward to in the 2022 season based off of what we've seen in the last 10 episodes, or just on the winner, whatever it is. I mean, like, I guess you'd start with Max versus Lewis round two. Do you think there's,
because that's too the way obvious. It ended, it goes without saying,
but because the way it ended, is there strangely more pressure on Max, or is he just going to be like, I'm a world champion, fuck y'all?
What are you trying to say? Like bubble title?
A little bit of bubble title. Yeah, I would say a little bit of bubble title.
Then I want Max to get a real one, if that's what people are going to say. All right, let's
ring.
Go ahead.
Although, ring.
Right, but
Checo Perez to Anthony Davis in this scenario?
I don't know. Checo, just watching that last race again and Checo doing what he did. And by the way, do you know that he didn't finish? He withdrew so that the car wouldn't be... Yeah, I didn't even realize that when I watched
Ultimate
the race.
Ultimate teammate.
Yeah, didn't finish just to get out of the mix. That's why I was, right? Just the odds of like, hey, we can't win as constructors, so... Let's just have one less car out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's fucking crazy. Okay. All right. So I'd like to see everybody's America's sweetheart, Daniel Ricciardo, bounce back a little bit. I needed more explanation. I thought he took a real hit in season four, both on the track and off the track with this show, because you could just hear everybody that was connected to McLaren talking about him being like, so what's up with this guy? And then at one point, even Horner was talking to one of the McLaren guys going, he's better than this. Like, what the fuck? What the fuck is up with him? It's just weird because you can't tell what's real and what isn't. With Ricciardo, you want to give him a bit more of the benefit of the doubt, but he's sitting there 10 weeks in going, I don't know how to control this car. I believe Ricciardo. I know Tsunoda, who I actually liked a lot towards the end of the season. I'm like, Yuki's fun to watch. He's aggressive. He's good. And then you watch the series. You're like, yeah, I don't think I'd want to hang out with him a ton. Ricciardo needs some sort of redemption here on the track big time, because now it's starting to feel like, oh, that funny guy that says dick in jokes and is good looking and laughs all the time. And he finishes eighth and Lando's twice the driver he is. Like he needs to have a comeback year big time.
The scene of him getting pissed off after Monaco and going away and stewing on a boat was very, very funny. Because they travel by boat, and it was great to see him just getting his little bag. He has his little bag, and he's throwing it in, and he's just like on a boat in Monaco. That's how they sped away. It was like Urban Meyer on the golf cart eating a pizza, except you're on a boat in Monaco.
Yeah, it was very F1, because it feels a bit like James Bond after a breakup, if he cared about a breakup. He's only cared about a breakup with Daniel Craig, which is just a way to modernize the scripts. But that's
I was going to say, Daniel Craig cared.
Yeah, Daniel Craig cared about breakups. All the I guess it's just some way they were like, we got to really balance this out and have him show that he gets bummed out when he breaks up with people, as opposed to all the other Bonds that get over it really quickly. I guess that's bad to get over it quickly.
I don't know. It depends what you want in a Bond.
I don't want him on, you know, Farmers Only. I mean, like, oh, I'm going to be in St. Pete this week. So see if maybe somebody wants to get together for tacos. How's it going, James? Oh, you know, I'm a little busted up. Seeing the Slovakian woman and... You know, just hasn't felt the same. Just haven't been going to the gym. It's James fucking Bond. I don't want that.
Yeah. No, I hear you, brother. I hear you. All right. Anything else in F1?
Nope. That's it.
Thanks, buddy.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, File a claim right on the State Farm mobile app and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right. One thing I'm really excited about with this show is getting to reach out and have conversations with people who've already made me smarter just as a fan of Formula One over the past couple of years. One of those people is Matthew Summerfield. He works at Motorsport Magazine. He writes about tech in a way that not many other people write about. Technology is so important to this series, and it changes week by week. It's amazing. And what's interesting about right now is we just have the testing period, and there's something called sandbagging, which is teams don't want to do as well as they could. You see that with Mercedes. Mercedes always says, we're not doing as well as we could. We're not going to win races this year. You always see that. Don't believe the headlines. You can go back to 2016 and see those headlines. It's a strange dance where bad teams want to look better. Good teams want to look worse. It's all very strange. But to walk us through it, Matthew Summerfield, thank you for joining us, buddy.
No problem. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So let's start here. We're learning a lot of new words over the past 2 weeks. We've known what ground effect is over the past few decades in Formula One, but now we have porpoising. Now we have side pods, which are along the side of the car and are wildly different depending on how teams interpret the rules. When you've been looking at this testing, knowing teams don't have the finished product, knowing teams are sandbagged, knowing teams are trying to hide something, what are you looking at in testing, Matthew?
Primarily, obviously, we've already had the launches of the cars. So Right. We've got lots of interesting new details this year because, as you mentioned, this is probably the biggest rule shakeup we've had in decades. It's a huge amount that the teams have had to go through to try to prepare themselves for this particular regulation set. But when we go to testing, then obviously you've got a lot of things that the teams are trying to hide. We talk about sandbagging a lot, and that is because the teams are trying to hide their performance from one another.
Right.
And you have to think about things like fuel load, which we don't know. You've then obviously got things like the different tyre compounds, which have an immediate effect on what performance that the drivers have to their capabilities. And there's just a huge amount of variables that kind of shake up the order so that nobody really truly knows where the pecking order is until we get to the first race.
Most interesting car for you this year is what?
I'm kind of torn between three.
Ooh.
And primarily that's because of the side pod designs that we've seen this year compared to what we've experienced in the past. So obviously you've got Mercedes with their, what we're calling zero pods. You've then got Red Bull with a very interesting design in terms of the way that theirs downwashes to the rear of the car. And then we've got the really interesting sort of, I'm kind of calling it more of a hot tub design on the Ferrari because of the way in which the top surface of the side pod is basically concave. And it, you know, you've got those the cooling louvers as well. So, there's loads of different interpretations this year on that side of things.
So explain this to me like an idiot, like I'm an idiot, because I am an idiot on some of these things, side pods being one of them. The side pods on the side of the car mean what for the car?
Okay, so inside the side pods, which they are what flanks the cockpit and then go rearward to the back of the car, you have things like the radiators, the intercoolers, and obviously then you bleed inwards towards the power unit and of all of the other electronics and whatnot. So basically the function of the side pods is to house components within them, but then also provide cooling to those components. Mm. And then on top of that, we obviously have the aerodynamics to consider. And so everybody has to trade off these different considerations to get to the kind of design that they're looking at.
One of the most interesting things you have to do before testing is look at the photographs from the launch and figure out what's new, what's interesting. What are people still hiding? Because there's obviously some of that, especially even in testing, people are still hiding it. I want to take the listener through the process of what you do and how you figure out what has changed from year to year when you're just looking at photographs of the launch, Matthew.
Okay, so first of all, this year is very different in that respect because we've got a different set of regulations. So you look at things like the front wing and the rear wing, and they are highly defined by the regulations themselves. We don't have the sort of flick-ups and whatnot that we used to have on the old front wings. And the rear wings are very much an aesthetic side of the regulations. Also, in as much as that they do help with the overtaking issue, which is what these regulations are framed to do. But when then you look elsewhere around the car, as you mentioned, there's a lot of things that I have to try to decipher. Things like the side pods have been extremely interesting this year, not only because we expected the teams to try to converge on solutions, i.e. we thought they would be very much similar in the way that they would approach things, but we've probably got 9 or 10 different solutions from all of the different teams in that respect. So, you know, there's a lot going on. And then on top of that, you have things like winglets appearing that you kind of think, well, how are they in the regulations? How have they managed to get those on the car? And then you have to kind of sit down and decipher what area in the regulations that they're allowed.
Manpower is an interesting thing to me because you heard in the middle of last year, okay, Mercedes is not putting all of their effort into 2021. Maybe they, you know, I heard the phrase skeleton crew for 2021. And then obviously Red Bull was going all in to win the World Drivers' Championship last year. And that ended up paying off in controversial fashion, but we're not going to relitigate that in this segment. But I'm curious what the push and pull is for most teams. Were most teams putting all of their eggs in the 2022 basket because of the regulations? Were some teams like Red Bull caught a little bit flat-footed? What are we going to, you know, when we start in, you know, next Sunday or this Sunday, are there going to be teams that noticeably were not as ready for the 2022 season, Matthew?
There will be some of that regard. In honesty, most of the teams would have had a huge amount of their resources placed onto this car very early into last season, just purely because of how much has changed on the car, the architecture of everything that we're talking about, from the suspension. We've got new tyres, we've got new wheel sizes, we've got wheel covers back, we've got everything about the car is a completely different layout to what we've had over the course of the last decade or so. And so obviously that means that there's a huge learning curve. And on top of that, obviously, then you've got the difference of resource between each team. Interestingly, though, we do have to consider the fact that now we do have a sliding scale within the regulations that allow the teams from the back end of the grid to have more resources compared to those at the front. And so that obviously has a bearing as well on that development race.
Is there one thing or a couple of things, as a matter, that teams are adjusting to that they are just not ready for? There's a regulation where they're just like, wow, we can barely understand this.
Well, the obvious thing is the porpoising that you mentioned earlier on. That's a component of the ground effect style of
The cars are bouncing. Just so the listener knows, the cars are bouncing in some cases, as like a dolphin. That's why they're calling it porpoising down the road, because of some of these regulation changes that haven't been adjusted to.
Yeah, it's an ill effect of basically the car pushing towards the ground under downforce, and then that mechanism then has to pop. Eventually pops back up, which then obviously causes this cyclic moment of porpoising. Some teams have done better with it than others, and I think that's a mechanism based on their decisions based on suspension design and also what they're doing on the edge of the floor. Now, that is one area that I think that we will see a huge development rate on, certainly at the start of the season, as all the teams try to find out ways in which to both solve porpoising and increase the performance of the cars.
One of the things that was really influential in my education as a Formula One fan a few years ago was Adrian Newey's book, How to Build a Car. And in the beginning of it, he said, when he looks at the regulations, he looks at what they say, but more importantly, he looks at what they don't say. And kind of nibbling around the edges of the rules are so important in this. Are there loopholes already showing themselves? Are there the loopholes you think are going to show themselves this season? And is there anyone, any team or any kind of mind in the sport right now who, like Newey, or maybe still is Adrian Newey at Red Bull, is going to find them? Kind of our we have Bill Belichick here in the States who immediately finds a loophole in football whenever there is one. What's that going to look like this year?
I don't think that we'll have the big sort of silver bullet moments that we've had in some of the other regulatory pasts, you know, like the double diffuser that we had in 2009, or even, you know, Ferrari's side pod solution that everybody converged towards when they introduced it in 2017. However, on the other flip side of that, you could argue that what Mercedes have done with their side pods is very much that kind of interpretation. You know, they're taking a look at the rules sideways, laterally, and interpreting them very differently to how some of the others might have done on the grid. That's not to say that it's the best idea. It's just that it's visually disarming. It looks very different to what the others have got.
I'm curious, as someone who understands the sport at such a technical level, can you even watch Drive to Survive? Like, it was amazing to me because when I was in episodes 9 and 10, they're obviously showing the last two races of the season. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, you know, there's normally not this much racing in this show. This show is about Formula One, but there's never actually racing like this because it's normally, hey, look, Lando Norris on a golf course sort of stuff. Can you appreciate it at that level, or does it drive you nuts as someone who knows it so intimately?
I'll be blatantly honest. I haven't watched Drive to Survive since Series 1.
That's exactly what I was looking for as a hardcore fan.
Yeah, it's so difficult for me to watch something that has been, I hate to use the word manipulated, but it's kind of not true to reality in many respects. You know, I understand editing from, you know, a broadcasting point of view and making plot points, etc. But to me, the Formula One already has a huge amount of drama to it. So to try to manipulate that further sometimes just doesn't sit well with me. And as I say, that's why I kind of can't get on the bandwagon, unfortunately.
Well, no, it's fascinating because I think that I made this point in our first episode. It's built to increase the drama when there is no drama. And so when there is so much drama as there was last year, it's almost ill-equipped to do so. It's almost ill-equipped to actually handle real life drama. And that's what's so interesting about it is that if you had just shown the last two races in the full, it'd probably be the exact same amount of drama as these kind of quick cuts, you know, 4K thing. It's just fascinating to see. I'm curious, you know, we have a lot of listeners in the States, and I think a lot of people are in different places on their F1 journey. And I'm probably never going to understand the cars at a super, super technical level just because I came to it late. I've been watching motor racing for since I was born, but it's never going to be that granular thing. I'm curious, when you were getting into it, what are the kind of educational steps you'd recommend to somebody who's trying to learn more about Formula One, how the cars are built, how the parts are put together? If somebody wanted to start the journey to become an extremely bad version of Matthew Sommerfeld, where would they start?
Well, firstly, I think that you have to remember that Formula One and motorsport in general is very niche in many respects. Right. So when you're talking about from an educational standpoint, most of people's approaches will not be based around motorsport to get into motorsport. And similarly, when people exit Formula One, they have the same sort of issue because they've got this very narrow mindset to creating something that is a prototype that will literally last for 1 week's worth of performance. You know, and then you're suddenly dealing with a whole new animal at the next race. And so it makes it very difficult for your experience to be able to be passed off in other industries. That's where I'm heading towards. Obviously, Motorsport Valley, being in the UK, kind of pushes people towards being in the UK to get involved with Formula One. Obviously, then you think that there are offshoots from that. You know, there's two teams in Italy, one in Switzerland, and you can't really class, I suppose, Haas as an American team, although they're American owned. Because
we can try, Matthew.
You can, but they've obviously got their base in the UK, and much of what they do is built in Italy via Dallara. Right. So, you know, it's the thing to think about with Formula One is that it's a very niche environment to work within. And much of what you learn within Formula One is sort of a microcosm of everything else around the world. You know, stuff from the aviation industry has some crossover with Formula One, for argument's sake, but it's not the same. Nothing's the same in Formula One.
Do you have books that you recommend when people are asking to get a more of a deep understanding of this?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're looking at it from a story perspective and understanding the sport at a base level, then I would suggest, as you mentioned earlier, Adrian Newey's book. There's a good one from John Barnard as well. If people don't know who John Barnard is, he was a designer for many of the teams, obviously Ferrari and McLaren being the big ones back in sort of the 80s and 90s, and produced some phenomenal innovations for the sport, things like semi-automatic gearboxes, you know, things that we take for granted now, that back then were massive for the sport. So his book is another one that I would recommend. And then obviously if you want to get into something a little bit deeper, then there are other race car engineering books that I'd probably recommend further down the line.
Interesting. Couple more for you. I want to start with, you mentioned the adjustments and how a lot of insights are good for 1 week at a time, and then everybody else catches up with you. And obviously it's usually the top teams everybody's catching up with. I remember Ross Brawn said something that I think about all the time, where he said that he thought that there were some years where the team that won the first week would be, if they made no adjustments, would be dead last in the last week of the season. That's how quickly it goes. And that's not common in American basketball. That's not, you know, that we just don't know that level of innovation where it's like, okay, you can just run the same stuff. I mean, people have been running cover two and cover three in football for 40 years, and they don't really need to make that many changes with it, right? You know, Dick LeBeau got away with it for 40 years. I'm curious what goes into those sort of adjustments now, you know, just for someone who doesn't understand it as much, like how much can a team change in a week? And what are some examples of just kind of week over week changes in Formula One that have really made a huge difference?
Okay. So I think the thing to remember is that those week on week changes are things that have been scheduled probably 12 to 15 weeks ago. So right. Formula One operates in a different sort of bubble in that respect. You know, it's not something that you can just go to do the next race and have a part. There are instances where that's possible, especially with things like 3D printing now, where smaller components can actually be made at the circuit itself. But that does have some limited scope. When we're talking about things like floors, wings, etc., then there's a huge amount of planning that goes into not only getting them designed, then built, but also shipped to the different tracks, which obviously you have to consider the fact that one front wing won't work particularly well at one circuit, whereas it will at another. You know, we have high, low, medium downforce configurations on cars. So, you know, if your schedule gets adjusted for whatever reason, which 2020 was a fine example of this, then obviously you end up in a situation where you can kind of be chasing your tail because you're out of the loop in terms of your development.
That's fascinating. Two more for you. First one is, you know, we always talk here about who won the offseason. It's always some random team that signed a bunch of free agents and they're not actually going to be that good. But is there a mid-pack team that you think made all the right moves that's going to be making noise that we didn't anticipate, Matthew?
Well, I hate to call them a mid-pack team, but they've kind of got that from the last few years. You'd have to say that Ferrari have probably
That is tough news for Ferrari, the mid-pack team making noise. But no, I get it. Go ahead.
Yeah, they've kind of been pushed back over the last few years. Yeah. But I do feel that this year they've kind of got all of their, you know, their bits and pieces in line, and I do feel like they've made a big leap forwards. Whether that is enough to vault them right to the front, we will have to see, but they certainly look as if they've made a big leap forward. In fact, what I will say is that because of these regulations and the reason why we've moved to these regulations in the first place, I think that we have seen some of the pack tightening up. You know, the midfield battle has always been incredibly tight, but you've always got this sort of distance between the front end and then the midfield. And I think perhaps we might see that might, you know, get tuned a little bit closer to one another.
Based on what you've seen so far, what does the top three look like this year for Constructors' Championship?
Ferrari, Red Bull, Mercedes, in my opinion.
Ferrari number one?
I would say so close. I think there's a variable on circuit characteristics as well. So whoever wins in Bahrain, don't expect them to win it in Saudi Arabia because it's a very different layout, track layout. And that obviously then feeds into how they set their cars up and what they've got in terms of development between the two races.
So is that just a constructors or is that a World Driver Championship as well that you would pick a Ferrari for?
I think the biggest problem that you've got with making that judgment very early on is that personally, I feel that out of the box, the Ferrari is very good, but does it have the scope to develop over the course of the season? And for me, for argument's sake, the Red Bull and the Mercedes designs are much more intricate and might take longer for them to get to work as they anticipate them to work. So you might see this sort of early lead from Ferrari, for argument's sake, but then very quickly the other two overtake them based on, you know, the fact that they can outdevelop their rival. It's going to be a fascinating season in that respect, if you ask me.
It's going to be wide open. I mean, it's going to be amazing, and it's going to be what I think if a lot of people got into F1 over the last 2 years, this is the year where there's a legitimate shakeup, and I'm really fascinated to see it. He's at Sommers, S-O-M-E-R-S, F1 on Twitter. He's great. He's Matthew Summerfield. Thank you so much for joining the Ringer F1 show.